just to say a few words about me.
I'm a professor at the University of Strasbourg in theology, in the Department of Protestant Theology. I grew up in a Protestant family. My father is from Switzerland, from a part of Switzerland that is historically Protestant. And my mother is from Normandy, from the west part of France, from a family that's Catholic originally, but converted to Pentecostalism back in the 1930s, so this branch of Protestantism. So I grew up in this religious environment with parents that taught me the Bible. That
Welcome.
Welcome. So maybe we'll have to add chairs in the end.
Yeah.
So I grew up learning about the Bible. Every day we would read the Bible, we would pray. So that has always been part of my heritage. Even my father was not a pastor or anything, but he was still very much interested in the Bible. He learned Hebrew and Greek. He took distance education. That's really funny. He basically taught himself Hebrew by himself, you know, which was quite unusual at the time. But I didn't notice it, because when I was a kid, it was normal. Like my father had a small library with study books, Bibles, and he had a Hebrew Bible. He had a Hebrew dictionary, a lexicon, and a Hebrew grammar. He had all the tools that we use to do exegesis and to learn biblical languages. And I thought it was normal. I thought every Christian family had that. And then when I grew up and I became a teenager, we were having Bible study groups in my church. And I would go and use those tools. You know, he had interlinear Hebrew and Greek Bibles. And I thought everybody had that at their home. And then discussing with other youths at the church, they said, but how do you have all that? I said, well, but it's at home, like, you know. And then I realized that my father was a bit different from the other people in the church. So basically, I've always been very passionate about the Bible. But of course, I had my own questions, and also my training, and I would say my mind is more leaning towards the hard sciences. I went and studied mathematics at the university. I have a bachelor's degree in mathematics, in fundamental mathematics. So that's really like, you know, you have proof, you have evidence, you have strict reasoning. And I also did physics, chemistry, computer science. So I was trying to have a very sharp reasoning and not, you know, come up with any fancy theory about whatever, you know. So, but I had all those questions about the Bible, and I decided to go and study theology. And this was a shock. The first semester was terrible, because I had all those professors teaching us about theology, about God, about the Trinity, about, you know, all those theological aspects. And I was in discussions between theologians, disagreements. I remember classes where they were discussing, you know, when you share when you have the Holy Communion, you know, that some Christian believers believe that it transforms into the body of Christ, and other people say no, it's just a symbol, and all of this was very troubling for me, because I thought, but on what basis, you know, what's the basis for all these dogmas? And I thought, you know, we need to go back to the Bible and make sure we better understand the Bible. And then when I learned biblical languages, so I thought, you know, by learning biblical languages, then I'll be able to know for sure what the Bible says. And that was a bit naive, of course, because immediately when I learned biblical languages, I realized that, well, there are all those words that we don't really know what they mean, both in Hebrew and in Greek. Like, well, you know, this is the only verse in which this Hebrew word occurs, and nobody knows what it means. I said, wow, that's terrible. How can we know? Well, it exists in other languages close to Hebrew, like Aramaic and Arabic, and this is the meaning in those languages, so maybe it's about the same meaning in Hebrew. I was like, okay, but still, you know, I'm not... And then, looking at some verses, they said, oh, but you know, there are different manuscripts, Hebrew manuscripts or Greek manuscripts, and they are not the same on that verse. You know, there are differences. I was like, what? So which one is the correct, you know, version? If there are different versions, even in Hebrew and Greek, how can I know it's the right one? So I thought, I need to study those ancient manuscripts. So And so that's why I focus more and more on the historical background that led to the birth of the Bible. What was going on at the time in the land of the Bible? What were the languages that people were speaking? For instance, when you have Hebrew words that people said it's a loan word from Akkadian. Akkadian was the language spoken in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, you know, so Babylon, you know, and those huge cities, and the languages are of the same family. So it's a loan word people use. Oh, okay, well, and so I wanted to learn those other languages. Okay, then I need to study Akkadian. And then there was this, like, word in Hebrew that people were not sure about the meaning. I remember we're talking about Rephaim, you know, if you know the verses in Isaiah and other books, you know, and only a few occurrences. We don't really know what it means, but we found in Syria at Ugarit, it's an archaeological site in Syria facing Cyprus, and we found tablets from the 13th century BCE. In a language that we call Ugaritic, because, you know, the city is Ugarit, so, you know, it's not very creative, but, you know, so we decided language was Ugaritic. And we find the same word, the Rephaim, you know, that, so, and then now we know what it means. Oh, okay, wonderful. So I thought I need to do more archaeology. I need to look for more manuscripts, for more inscriptions. So this became my specialty, I would say. Now I specialize in digging up ancient texts, whether on parchment or papyrus or stone or pottery. So, for instance, yesterday we were at the French Research Center. We were imaging, taking photographs of new inscriptions that were found in Marecha, Bet Gouvrin. I don't know if you visited the place. You have caves. It's really nice. You can go with your kids. This is a big archaeological site. We are conducting excavations there, and we have found hundreds of Aramaic inscriptions from the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE. Hundreds of Aramaic inscriptions, but also hundreds of Greek inscriptions. And even yesterday, one of them was a bilingual. You had one line in Aramaic, one line in Greek, on the same piece. And so we saw it yesterday for the first time. So you see, this is ongoing research, and you see now how I'm going to the topic. By looking at what was going on here in the region, but at the time of the Bible, we know better who were the people who wrote the Bible, what was their life like, what was their culture, or the cultures in plural that were around. And we realize more and more that the region was not populated by a single people with a single culture. It was not a homogeneous society, it was a multicultural society. And people were switching from one language to another very easily. So we get to know more by doing archaeological excavations. So we have more and more documentation, more and more inscriptions. I'm also publishing now a bunch of Hebrew inscriptions, about 450 new inscriptions that date to the end of the Kingdom of Judah, that is around 600 BCE, right? Just before the Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem. So we have, this is twice as much as all of the other inscriptions that we know so far. So when we publish this is going to be a major, major improvement in our knowledge of what was going on in the region 600 years BCE. And of course, we know more about the Hebrew language, because now we have actual texts written by people at that time. And that is different from looking at manuscripts that are much later. Very often, like if you read your Bible, the text that you have is actually either a reprint from an edition from the 16th century CE, the time that the printing press, you know, Gutenberg invented, or, you know, developed, I would say, printing press, and very quickly you have Hebrew Bibles that are printed, and usually they've been reprinted, it's the same text. Or they are based on a medieval manuscript, the Leningrad Codex. Maybe you've seen it. It's the oldest complete Hebrew Bible. Probably you've heard about it in the first part of that series of lectures. This is from basically 1000 AD, so it's an old manuscript. Here in the Israel Museum, you have a manuscript that's about the same period, which is the Aleppo Codex. You can go and see it. It's here. It's not complete though, so you cannot use it as. We cannot use it. It's not complete. Part of it has burned, especially the Torah, the first part of the Pentateuch. Didn't really burn, actually. I think the leaves were taken off. People usually say it burned, but there are actually no trace of burning. So I think that's a story people tell to explain that it disappeared. But I think the real story is that people took it off to keep for themselves. But anyway, so it's part of it is missing. So we cannot use it as a complete Bible. But it's just to let you know that usually when you read the Hebrew Bible and you have the text in front of you, the text that you are reading is actually from a medieval manuscript that is much later compared to the time of the events of the biblical writers. So for me, it's very interesting to go back in time and find inscriptions or manuscripts that are from the time of the Bible. So I did my PhD on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and you probably all know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran, Murabaat, Masada, all those archaeological sites by the Dead Sea. When people excavated there, they found manuscripts, and they date from the turn of the era, from the time of Jesus, more or less, a few hundred years before or after, but it's about the same time period. And there, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible. Manuscripts of Genesis, of Deuteronomy, of the Book of Psalms, of all of the books of the Hebrew Bible, you will find them there, except for the Book of Esther, but that's probably just a coincidence. And then the surprise is that, there are Hebrew manuscripts, but there are also Aramaic manuscripts. Okay. Oh, but there are not only Aramaic manuscripts, there are Greek manuscripts. Greek manuscripts of the Bible, of the Book of Exodus, of Genesis. So the question is, why would people have a Greek manuscript of the Book of Exodus if they had the Hebrew manuscript, right? So we thought, like, the Book of Exodus, the Torah was written in Hebrew, so why don't people just go ahead and read the Hebrew text? Why would they have a Greek version of that book? And so this raises the issue of Greek as a language of Judaism. Very often we think of Greek as the language of Christianity. Jews, they have Hebrew, and Christians, they have Greek. And what I'm going to try and tell you this morning, the idea, is to see that this was not the case. This is how we perceive things now. And the reason why we perceive it now, it's because people wanted us to look it that way. At some point in history, language was used as a way to set apart Christians and Jews. So that's what we are going to. This is, I'm already telling you the end of the lecture. So if you have to go, you can go now. Yeah. But what we'll try to do this morning is to go through the process, right? To the steps, what happened slowly, and how did we go from point A to point B. So is that okay with you? The outline of what we're going to do this morning? Okay. At any time, if you have a question, don't hesitate to stop. We're not that many, and I'm glad, because I can be more effective in answering your questions. When I speak in front of like hundreds of people, I hope that what I'm saying is answers people's questions. But maybe I'm just wrong, and then of course at the end we can have a few questions. But that's
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm feeling cold or hot. Yes, air conditioning.
So yes, don't hesitate to ask any question at any time. I can adjust and make sure that I answer your questions. And if there are things that you already know, we can skip that, or on the contrary. Yes?
From what you said earlier, it raises two points in my head. You mentioned there's an advantage of looking at inscriptions and texts from the period of time rather than a manuscript. So now, there's two questions here, the concept of Masorah, tradition, right? So sometimes, like for example, we had an extant the manuscript, the MS, the Masoretic text.
Mm-hmm.
So people say, well, it's old because they had a physical edition from the 12th century thing. But apparently there's this tradition that it was even started 1,000 years earlier.
Yeah.
So one is how, even if we go back to that time, like the Dead Sea, and we see writings, so who wrote these writings? If it was a Jew, so does that necessarily represent Pharisaic Judaism? It could be from the Essenes in a different thought. So what becomes canonical in authority, a lot of times depends on the source.
Of course. And you're right. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have scrolls that are very close to the Aleppo Codex or the Leningrad Codex. Of course, at the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we don't have the Teamim, you know. So you only have the consonantal text. But judging just by the consonantal text, we can say it's quite close to those medieval manuscripts. So indeed, those medieval manuscripts were faithful, in a sense, to an older tradition. And this tradition dates back at least to the 2nd century CE. We have a few manuscripts from the Dead Sea that date after the destruction of the temple. And so early 2nd century CE, the time of Bar Kokhba, you know, so in those caves. And there's a switch clearly between manuscripts before that and after that. All of the biblical manuscripts after that, so from the 2nd century CE, all of them are almost identical to the Masoretic text, so the medieval text that are still in rabbinical Bibles today. So this is evidence that the tradition, at least the consonantal text, was already fixed, in a sense, in the 2nd century CE. Now, of course, there may be discussions as to which vowel should be put, of course, because sometimes you have the same consonantal text, and of course, depending on the vowel, can be a noun, can be a verb, so there can be discussions around that, but at least, I would say, consonantal text was fixed. And it was probably even earlier than the 2nd century CE, because we have a few Dead Sea Scrolls that are a bit earlier than that, 1st century CE, perhaps 1st century BCE, that are also very, very close, almost identical. But that's not all of the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Other Dead Sea Scrolls, so if you put side by side, I don't know, you have like 30 or 40, let's say, well, the Book of Deuteronomy, for instance, is the one they have. You have 40 scrolls of Deuteronomy, so it's huge. Or the Book of Psalms, you almost have 40 copies of the Book of Psalms. If you put them side by side, you would say, okay, some of them are close to the later Masoretic text, others are not close. And so it shows that there were different communities, different groups that had different versions of the text, and that the Masoretic text represents one of these groups. So of course, usually you would say this is the Pharisees versus maybe the Essenes or the Sadducees or Samaritans or other groups at the time. It's not always easy to associate one type with one group. But as for sure, it tells us that Judaism at the time, again, was not a single form of Judaism. Now, Judaism as we know it today is mainly rabbinical Judaism, right? Even though within rabbinical Judaism, of course, you have a lot of different groups, of course, you know, but they would agree that, you know, we had the Mishnah, we had the Talmud, and that would be the tradition within which, oh, of course, you can have Karaite Jews, but how many are there? You know, you have a few Samaritans, but how many are there? You know, so for most people, when you say Judaism today, everybody thinks of rabbinical Judaism, right? But when you go back to the time, at the beginning of the era, at the time of Jesus, there were many different groups. And it's difficult to tell which of those groups had the majority. We can tell which ones had power in the temple, for instance, and consider the Sadducees had the power in the temple in Jerusalem. But if you read Jewish historians like Flavius Josephus, who write in the first century CE, he introduces different Jewish groups, and you can tell that all of those groups had power in a sense and followers, and then a lot of people were in between. You know, it's like, I don't know, you have political elections coming up, you know, so you have big parties that everybody knows of, and then you have smaller parties, and then you have people that are in between, and if I have to vote, well, I don't know, should I vote for him or for him or for her, you know. A lot of people do not necessarily belong to one of these groups. When you study religion, not from archives coming from temples or religious centers, but when you excavate homes of people, so real actual people, workers, you can see that usually the religion of the basic people is not the same as the religion of the priests, of the, you know, of the high society, right? So even things that are maybe forbidden in the Torah, you find them put into practice in religion, like divination and stuff, you know, the people are not supposed to do, and the Torah condemns, you know, you shouldn't do that. Well, we know that people were doing it, you know. It's also a reason why it's condemned, you know, you don't have to condemn it if people are not doing it. So we have a better perspective on what was going on at the time. Now, among those scrolls, then, we have Greek manuscripts. So how come that we have Greek manuscripts of the Torah, of other books of the Bible? There are historical sources that tell us why, in what circumstances. One of these sources, well, we have basically two major sources, so I'll put them on the screen so that you know how to write them. We have the letter of Aristeas. That's one source, and the other source is Philo of Alexandria. So those are two sources, historical sources, that tell us why the Bible was at some point translated into Greek, the Hebrew Bible. Then we'll talk about books written in Greek. But now, and so basically they tell us that this takes place in Egypt, not here in Jerusalem, but in Egypt, that there was a Jewish community in Alexandria. You know where Alexandria is in Egypt, right? Alexandria was not an Egyptian city. It's in Egypt, but it was not an Egyptian city. It was a Greek city. So just a little bit of history. Alexander the Great was a Hellenistic ruler. He came from Macedonia, from Greece, if you will, right? And he took over in the 4th century BCE. So his name, Alexander the Great. If you don't know him, and if you're not very much interested in history, you can still watch movies. There was a big movie in the US, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, with this, I don't know which famous actor, but you know, so they tell his story basically. So it's, yeah, you can go ahead and watch the movie, you'll see.
What's the name of it?
I don't know. Maybe, yeah. So what was the name of the movie? So that's this movie, 2004, right? Alexander. Yeah, so just call Alexander. So you can, and of course, don't expect it to be like very accurate, you know, historically and everything. But still, it gives you an idea of what was going on at the time. So basically, at the time, Alexander took power when the rulers were Persians. So I'll just show you on the map where that goes. Yeah. Basically, in the 6th century BCE, the Persians take over. And if you know the Bible, you know a guy named Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. He's mentioned in the book of Isaiah as being God's Messiah. So basically, these guys in Iran, if you will, take over power in Iraq, that is Babylon, and they extend their power all the way to Egypt, to the south of Egypt, all the way to Ethiopia, and there they go all the way to the Indus Valley. So they have this huge, even Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, all the way here. So they have this huge empire, right? It's called the Persian Empire, and the dynasty is the Achaemenid dynasty. Their language is Persian, but they think that for practical purposes, imposing that language as an administrative language of the entire empire is not practical. So they decide to choose an easy language that is already quite in use, and it's Aramaic. So the Persians are smart, and they say, well, we want people to be happy, so let's use Aramaic. And Aramaic will become the official language of this huge empire, of this huge empire. So everybody writes Aramaic. And we found papyri in the south of Egypt, in Elephantine, where there was, by the way, a Jewish community, and they had a temple in Elephantine. So they write to the priests in Jerusalem. They have the Jews that have their temple in Elephantine, and Jews that have their temple in Jerusalem. So they correspond to each other, and we have the letters. And all the way here to Uzbekistan, you also have scribes that write administrative work, documents, letters, and they have the same language. They write the same way. The script is the same. So they had excellent schools to train scribes at the time. And this lasts for about two centuries. And there comes this guy from Greece, from up there, you know, not down Greece here, but rather, you know, like modern day Macedonia, you know, that region. And he is ambitious. He's young and ambitious, and ambitious, and his name is Alexander. And in a few years, because the Persian Empire was quiet and nice and peaceful, and, you know, they were not expecting huge armies to fight against them, they were taken by surprise. And Alexander the Great, so in the 4th century BCE, will quickly conquer, you know, like Turkey. He will fly there, and Syria, Lebanon, all those, you know, Egypt and Iraq and Iran. I'm using the modern day names of those countries, of course. So in a few years, he conquers all of the Persian Empire. He will die very young. He goes all the way, you know, to India and you know, but the Himalayas, and he becomes sick, and he wants to go back home, but he dies on the way in Babylon. You know, he doesn't have time. So in his 30s, he's only like, you know, in his 30s, he's younger than me, you know, and so he does this, and then he dies. After his death, there are, of course, other ambitious people who want to take over. And there will be different kingdoms, we might say. And here Judea will be in between two kingdoms, one around Egypt and one around Syria. And there will be numerous wars between those two guys. Again, those kingdoms are Greek, right? So even if you are in Egypt, you might think, well, but these are Egyptians, right? They speak Egyptian, and, you know. Well, there are Egyptians in Egypt, of course, who speak Egyptian, the Egyptian language, of course. But at that time, this has become a Hellenistic kingdom, a Greek-speaking kingdom. So the capital is Alexandria. Alexandria is a new city. It's named after Alexander. So they call it Alexandria to please Alexander, right? It's the same thing here. You have Caesarea that was named after Caesar, or even Tiberias up in Galilee. So it's common practice. You know, you build cities and you give them names of the kings, and, you know, they're happy with it. So Alexandria is a Greek-speaking city. A lot of Greeks settled there. There are Egyptians, but they're not in power. And the same thing happens in Syria, where Syria is ruled by Hellenistic rulers, Greek-speaking rulers. And they will fight with each other numerous wars, five wars. And usually their battlefield is in between, that is here in Judea. So very often Judea is the battlefield between the Seleucid rulers in Syria and the Lagid rulers in Egypt. So they have two dynasties, you might say, two dynasties of Greek rulers, and they fight.
What was the name of Alexander?
Okay, so they, yeah, so you had the Seleucids.
That's in Syria.
And versus the Lagids.
Lagids.
Yeah. Oh, you don't say that. You should. Yeah. And then, of course, Greek culture will penetrate the whole region. People will start learning Greek and using Greek as a trade language. If you want to do business, you have to do it in Greek. That's not what the language that people would speak on a daily basis, mainly Aramaic would be their language. Here in the region, people also speak Hebrew. But around Jerusalem and Judea, I would say, up north in Galilee, not much. Based on archaeological finds, we can see that in Galilee, people speak only Aramaic. They probably know Hebrew quite well, but by that time they speak Aramaic. In Judea, it's different. Around Jerusalem, we still find Hebrew inscriptions, so we guess people were still using Hebrew as a spoken language. And then we have a number of inscriptions in Aramaic, more Aramaic than Hebrew, but you know, we have both. But then, of course, by that time, we start seeing Greek inscriptions more and more. And people speak Greek for trade, for economy, for administration. Greek becomes a very well-known language. And then, of course, you have Jewish communities all over the place. And you also have Jewish communities in Alexandria. And Philo of Alexandria is a Jew. He's a philosopher. He's an exegete. He writes commentaries on Genesis, on Exodus. So he writes commentaries. He lived at the same time as Jesus, right? The turn of the era. And so he writes dozens of books. And I encourage you to read his writing. It's very interesting. And in one of those books, he talks about the Greek Bible. And he says, well, you know, basically you have Jews that have lost Hebrew as a spoken language after generations. You know, they spoke Aramaic for some generations, and then they switched to Greek. And after a few generations, it's easy to lose a language. You know, some people settle in a country. I had a great grandmother who spoke German, but then she came, and so my mother remembers that when she was a kid, her grandmother would speak this kind of dialect from Alsace, from the region of Strasbourg, so this kind of German dialect. But that's all she could remember. And now I come one generation later, have no idea. It's completely lost. So it doesn't take long. It takes only three, four generations for a language to be lost if it's not practiced. And so that's why Jews that settled in Egypt after some point know Aramaic much better than Hebrew. They still know a little bit of Hebrew, but not that much. And then after a few generations again, they switch to Greek. So now you have all those Jews whose language is Greek. And it's only Alexandria. We have evidence of Jewish communities throughout the Mediterranean Sea. And by the time of the Roman Empire, when the Romans take over, the time of Jesus, the Romans will use Latin as their administrative language. But Latin will never replace Greek as a trade language, as the international language. So people keep speaking Greek. And we have Jews speaking Greek all over the Mediterranean. And that's their native language. That's how they speak Greek every day. And they might know some Aramaic, but not that much. And Hebrew, forget it. So what do? You translate the Bible into Greek so that they could read the Greek language. And so that's how, in around the 3rd century BCE, in Alexandria, Jews translate the Torah into Greek. This translation is called the Septuagint, which means 70, because of course there's this tradition that says that there was this group of 70 translators, or sometimes 72, you know, so it was a multiple of 12, you know, one for each tribe of Israel, and you know, so they have six for each tribe, for each of the 12 tribes. But anyway, so they have this story of how they made the translation, and you even have stories that say that they independently translated. So each one made the translation, and then they compared the translations, and they were identical, which is a miracle, you know. Like, we can try, you know, I give you a text in Isaiah, translate it, and then we compare. It's never going to happen. So this is seen as a miracle and a sign that basically God approves the translation. And so Philo of Alexandria will say that the Greek scriptures are not the daughters of the Hebrew scriptures, but they are the sisters. You see the difference? They are sisters. And he will say that the translators were prophets. They were not just translators, they were prophets. That is, they were speaking God's word. So his point is that we Jews in Alexandria who use Greek scriptures, we are not inferior to Jews who use the Hebrew scriptures. And he has to make a point, because it's not obvious. And for most people, they would say, okay, you have a Greek translation, but what matters is the Hebrew, because that's the original language, right? A translation, of course, has issues, has weaknesses. You can never fully translate something in a language to another language. You know, and you can, even nowadays, I mean, if I speak this, there are some things I can say in French, I can try and say them in English. It's not going to sound exactly the same way, you know. So every language has its own specificities that you cannot translate to another language. So most people would assume that a translation is not as good as the original. So Philo of Alexandria has to make a point. He has to explain himself. And his point is to say, this was not just a translation. The translators were prophets. And also there are these stories, so six from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and they, you know, work independently, they compare, the translations were identical. It's a miracle. So basically the Greek scriptures, according to him, are really God's word. Yes?
Yeah, so first of all, you mentioned the scripture in the Bible, but we're specifically talking about that Septuagint.
Yeah.
Is only the first five.
Exactly.
Books.
Yeah. It's the Torah. Yeah, exactly. And it's good that you mentioned that, because very often, and that was going to be my next point, very often people talk about the Septuagint as any Greek translation of any book of the Hebrew Bible, which is incorrect. To be accurate, the Septuagint is only the translation of five books. And this took place in Alexandria, for what we know, and not necessarily for the other books, but I'll come to that in a minute.
And I think there's a different viewpoint of Philo versus the rabbis at the time. The Talmud records the differences, actually, where these seven rabbis translated the same thing, and it was all so that the non-Jews wouldn't get the wrong idea. Now what happened with the Septuagint, with the rest of the Bible, that seems to be more of something that was in Christian hands. But the authors may have been Jewish Hellenistic, but you're not sure.
So I'll come to that, but that's not the case, because now we have the Dead Sea Scrolls that show that this was not the case. That this was made by Christian Jews, or Christians with the help of Jews.
So it was Jewish Hellenists?
Yeah. So that's the story. But if you look at the text itself, and if you compare this Greek translation with the Hebrew Bible that we have now, there are huge differences. Sometimes entire chapters, look at the book of Jeremiah, for instance, you have whole blocks of chapters that are elsewhere. Sometimes chapters that are not there. So there are, you know, most of the books are shorter in Greek than in Hebrew. I wrote a book on the book of Joshua, for instance, chapter 10, and I did a very detailed comparison verse by verse between the Hebrew and the Greek, and there are major differences. So what Philo says is just not true. That's a story he had to make a point to say, you know, to justify the fact that they were using the Greek version and the Greek scriptures and not the Hebrew scriptures. Also, we now realize that the Greek translation very often translates Hebrew words not in their Hebrew meaning, but in their Aramaic meaning, right? For instance, let's say chesed, for instance, which in biblical Hebrew means loyalty at the time. But then the word evolved in Aramaic, it became more and more something like benevolence. And that's what you find in a Greek translation. Eleos in Greek means bounty and kindness, goodness, which is not the original meaning of the Hebrew word. And by the way, the Hebrew word has also evolved in the rabbinical literature. So the word itself has evolved. But it shows Aramaic influence. Even when they talk about, let's say, Passover, Pesach, they didn't know how to translate into Greek, so they just transliterated it. So they said, this is how we pronounce it, except that they didn't pronounce it Pesach, they pronounced it Pascha. Pascha is the Aramaic translation of Pesach. So we have a number of examples that show that actually the Greek translators of the Septuagint knew Aramaic much better than Hebrew, and that very often their knowledge of Aramaic influenced their reading of the Hebrew Bible, right? So it's just to let you know that there's the story and then there's the history, right? So what I'm trying to make the difference. The story is that, oh, this is a miracle, and so they were prophets, and the Greek scriptures are, this is not the case. There are huge differences. Now, what about, I said earlier, sometimes the chapters are not there, they are elsewhere, verses are missing, or, you know, is this, like, were they like creative translators? Were they like, oh, you know, I'll do this, I'll do that, or were they just bad translators? No. The Dead Sea Scrolls shed some light on it. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found Hebrew manuscripts that have basically the same differences that we knew from the Greek version. Let's say, I said earlier, the book of Jeremiah. In the Greek version of the book of Jeremiah, there are chapters that are not there. And so we thought, is this the Greek translator who removed the chapter? Why? You know? But now, actually, we have found Hebrew manuscripts that also lack the same chapter. Which means that this was not something that the Greek translators did. They basically did a translation of the Hebrew text that they had in front of us, in front of them. But the Hebrew text that they had in front of them was different from the Hebrew text that we have now, right? So you remember earlier I told you in the Dead Sea Scrolls we have different versions of the books of the Bible. One of them is the Masoretic text, the one that, you know, was chosen by the rabbis to be the official text of rabbinical Judaism. But there were other versions of Genesis, Deuteronomy, Psalms. And basically, those other versions were in circulation.
What were they called?
That we don't have any name for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were other versions. So sometimes people would call them Septuagint-like, you know, because when we discovered those Hebrew scrolls, scholars said, oh, but it's there's like in that psalm, the psalm is missing that verse, and we have the same phenomenon in the Greek version. So now we realize that this phenomenon was not specific to the Greek translation. It was already in the Hebrew. Which means that the Hebrew manuscripts that they were using were not the same Hebrew, the same version, the same Hebrew version as Rabbinic Judaism has been using until today.
Do we know the authors of these different types of manuscripts?
No idea. That's a lot of research is ongoing right now. And to see what, you know, at what stage, like for instance, like who moved the chapter, like for instance, if you compare those two manuscripts of Jeremiah. I have a paper next month in a book on the history of Jeremiah, and one of the chapters I wrote is exactly looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls of Jeremiah and trying to figure out the history of the book of Jeremiah. So at what stage was this chapter moved, and in what way or another, because like if you have two manuscripts and in one manuscript the chapter is in the middle of the book, and another manuscript, the chapter is at the end of the book, like the oracles against the nations are in the middle of the book, in one manuscript, at the end of the book, in another manuscript. So the question is, who moved the chapters, and who was first? Like, was it first in the middle, and somebody moved it to the end, or was it first at the end, and somebody moved it in the middle? So these are all sorts of discussions, and I try to have some, to look at the manuscripts, to have something material to work on. But there's not much. So a lot of this is conjectural. So you can read people who say, I think the switch was made from this way and people say, no, I think it was the other way around, there's no proof, there's no real evidence. So we can try and discuss, but beyond that, there's not much we can do. But what's for sure is that the Greek translation was based on another version of the Hebrew Bible, and very often a shorter text of the Hebrew Bible. So it was an earlier version of the Hebrew Bible, if you will, before a number of verses were added. So that's also interesting, because we can say that between the 3rd century BCE and the 2nd century, or even 1st century CE, this is in this time frame that some verses were added, and the text grew up a bit bigger. It's very interesting
for
that.
How do you know it was added rather than taken away?
That's a good point, actually. So some people make the argument that it's the other way around, that some verses were... And this may be true in a few cases. And in Jeremiah, this may be true, actually, in some passages of Jeremiah. But overall, in most cases, when there's a verse that's added, it clarifies. You know, if you, so the global picture, if you list all of the differences and all of the verses that are added in one book and not there in one version and not there in another version, usually you can see that those verses make the text clearer. So it's probably someone who thought, oh, someone might misunderstand the text. I'll just clarify it, you know, add one sentence to make sure that... So don't think that people were ill-intentioned. I know that sometimes people who are critical of the Bible, and especially some Muslims that say, you know, the Bible is falsified, but the Quran is perfect and everything. So they say, look, you know, if you compare the oldest manuscript of the Bible, there are differences, verses here and there are missing at it. So you see people are falsifying the text. I said, no, if you look at what's going on, people are improving the text. They are making sure that the text is better understood. And actually, in the Greek translation, sometimes you can see that people were trying to adapt the text to a Greek audience. Say, well, you know, we want to speak to people who, you know, because it's different if you are a Jewish minority in Egypt and you have texts, let's say, that say that, you know, the nations will bow down and we will subdue them. And if you have your Greek neighbor that reads that, is this really your intention? Are you really going to, you know, fight us and kill us and subdue us? And, you know, so they soften a little bit the text, like the nations will come and embrace the Messiah. You know, they had that in the book of Amos, for instance, in other books of the Bible. So you can see that in the Greek translation, you can see that the translator tried to, you know, adjust a little bit, because they know that they are in a context where they are in minority and they don't want to be have trouble with the Greek authorities. So this phenomenon is really fascinating. Then I'm looking at the time. What time is?
You can have lunch half past 11. So you have 20 minutes to go.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
We'll, make it shorter and open up for questions.
Yeah, I'm almost done now. Then there's the question of the other books. So we talked about the Torah in Alexandria, 3rd century BCE. Then there are other translations of other books. I talked about Joshua, Jeremiah, Amos. Basically, all of the books of the Hebrew Bible have been translated into Greek. And so the question was who translated those books, where? And the assumption was for a long time that it was also made in Alexandria in Egypt by the same group of Jews. That's probably not the case. Why? Well, first, according to Philo of Alexandria and the letter of Aristeas, they only referred to the Pentateuch, to the Torah. So, I mean, if they had translated everything, why didn't they say so? I mean, they should have said, well, we translated all of the scriptures and, you know. No. They only talk about the Torah, the five books of Moses, and that's it. So why would you think that they would translate other books? Second, we know that at the time, there was a discussion about which books had authority, what we call canonical books. The term canonical is a Christian term, comes from the Greek actually, to say it's something that has authority, that is the norm. The canon is the norm. So books that are normative, that are authoritative. And a lot of Jews at the time considered that only five books had authority, and that's the five books of Moses. Like the Sadducees, for instance, they had only five books. The Samaritans, they had only five books. A number of Jewish groups consider that you have only five books that have authority. There are other books that are around, and okay, why not? They're not that bad. Why not? But they don't have the same authority. Other groups felt that more books had authority, like the Pharisees, for instance. The Essenes had even more books that they thought had authority. So the idea of which books have authority was an ongoing debate at the time. And the Jewish community in Alexandria obviously was interested in the five books of Moses. And they said, these are the books that have authority in the 3rd century BC. These are the books that need to be translated into Greek. But of course, other groups ascribed authority to other books, and they also translated them into Greek. And we don't know exactly where, but the oldest manuscripts were not found in Egypt. They were found here in Judea, the Dead Sea Scrolls. At Qumran, you have lots of Greek manuscripts in Cave 4. Cave 7 had only Greek manuscripts. Only Greek manuscripts in Cave 7. And so a lot of scholars, and especially Emmanuel Tov, who is a professor here at the Hebrew University, I was at his home yesterday night. We had a nice evening. And so he's maybe the best Dead Sea Scrolls scholar in the world. He's still teaching a little bit. He's retired, but he's still teaching a little bit at Hebrew University. And we agree, I mean, I agree with him that most of those books were actually translated in Judea by Jewish groups who ascribed authority to those books. So you have a Greek translation of Jeremiah, you have a Greek translation of Joshua, you have a Greek translation of all sorts of books, of the Book of Psalms. You even have a Greek translation of the Book of Enoch. So some of you might not know about the Book of Enoch. Enoch is one of the patriarchs in the Book of Genesis in chapter 5, you know, between Adam and Noah. In 7th position you have Enoch, and then he's a strange character because the text says "Ve'enenu oto ki lakachoto Elohim," and then he was not because God took him. Oh, what happened to him? Well, yeah. And then did he go up to heaven? Did he die? Did, you know, something strange happened? And yes, in some Jewish literature and traditions, and we have Midrashim, we have lots of literature, say, well, actually, he went up to heaven, he had revelations from the angels, and he came back, and so on, and now he's an angel, and he's Metatron, which is a Greek term, by the way. So, Enoch, there's a Book of Enoch, and it was written in Greek, in Aramaic, sorry, but it was also translated in Greek. And again, the question is, who? And until recently, we thought maybe Christians translated into Greek, because the oldest Greek manuscript we had was from Egypt. But now we found Greek Enoch among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we now have evidence that there was a Greek translation of the Book of Enoch in Judea before the birth of Christianity. So this shows that, you know, it was a thing to translate into Greek, even here in Judea. People who had those books, they wanted to have them in Greek. I say, why would they want them in Greek? Again, because Greek was a very common language, even here in Judea. We have evidence, like Bar Kokhba, when he writes letters, you might say, well, he's going to write in Hebrew. Of course, most often he writes in Hebrew, but sometimes he writes in Greek. So we also have Greek letters of Bar Kokhba to someone else in Greek. A lot of people spoke Greek at the time. Greek was not seen as a foreign language necessarily, as, you know, like we are Jews and Greek is the language of other people, but not us Jews. There are even literary works that were composed in the Greek language. So we have Greek Jewish literature before the birth of Christianity. So you have Jews who say, oh, I want to write, I don't know, a story, like narrative, or I want to write poems or songs or all sorts of, think of any literary genre. We have Greek literature, not only translation into Greek, but people who would write in the Greek language, Greek literature, Jewish literature, before the birth of Christianity. And this is why when Christianity was born, Greek was a natural language for writing a number of books for the disciples of Jesus, including the Jewish disciples of Jesus. But this is going to be the second part, so I don't want to rush into that. Yes?
There are some Christians who are claiming the thought that the original New Testament was actually written in Hebrew and the Greek version is the translation.
Yeah.
What do you say? Is it a myth or a complete
picture? So, well, I wanted to talk about that in the second part, but since you asked the question, no, but that's fine, let's go ahead. That's a good question. But it will take time. I think it's better to keep that question for the after the break.
Can you say a little about the letter of Tereus and how that compares to the
Liturgy? The letter of Aristeas is also a Jewish text that also relates in length. It tells about the relationship of the Jewish community with the Greek or the Hellenistic rulers. And it tells about their situation and their diplomatic relations. And it tells also about the story of the Greek translation. And then they said that, of course, they have another idea that the Torah was translated into Greek at the request of the king. That the king wanted to say, I'd like to have in my library, the famous Library of Alexandria, I'd like to have all the literature of the world. And so the Jews, this strange religion, they have sacred books. I'd like to be able to read them in Greek. So please translate them into Greek. So that's the version of the story. And again,
is that different than the Septuagint five books?
No. It's also the story of the Septuagint. Yeah. So it's also the letter of Aristeas also tells the story of the Septuagint, how it came into existence. And then you also have in the letter of Aristeas the same story with the 70 or 72. Jewish scholars who will translate and then compare. So it's a similar story with Philo of Alexandria. We don't know who, if it's a real. I mean, the thing is that
he was a Jew.
Yeah, but so the thing is that I'm not sure, and I'm not the only one. I mean, but it's not sure that it's
actually
a real letter.
Some say it's not exactly.
Yeah. There are a lot of inaccuracies from what we can tell in the letter. So it seems to have been written long after, and someone pretending to be, oh, this is the letter and so on that I write, and which was actually a literary genre at the time. Like, you know, if I want to say something, one of the literary device that I could use is to pretend I'm writing a letter to someone. And this is ongoing even today. I mean, like, at least in French literature, I know of a number of French writers like Blaise Pascal and others who famously wrote letters that were not addressed to an actual person. They invented someone. They invented, like, I'm writing to that person, and that person wrote back to me, except the person never existed, right? But it's just a way to write, you know, and to tell a story. So there are reasons to believe that the letter of Aristeas is not accurate, is not historical, was written later, and again to explain why those Jews are using a Greek, how come that there's a Greek translation, and why are they using it instead of the Hebrew version. Yes, the Septuagint. The term Septuagint means 70, right? And so it refers specifically to the translation of the five books of Moses, the Torah. Why those five books? Probably because these were the books that they ascribed authority to. Like, for instance, Philo of Alexandria writes commentaries on the five books of Moses. He doesn't write a commentary on any other book. And most of his quotations, even in other books, he discusses, you know, he has dozens of books. And every time he wants to quote scripture as authority, like, you know, it is written, it's always the five books of Moses. Very, very seldom does he refer to the book of Samuel or the book of Psalms, or, you know, you can say that for him, those books do not have the same kind of authority as the books of Moses. Yeah, and also because people thought that these are, you know, this is God's word, the Torah. I mean, this is the, you know, the word Torah is like, you know, the revelation, so the instruction. So
I think it can actually, even according to the Jewish tradition, was a bit later. It was after that. So it's there's no reason necessarily.
Yeah.
There was a tradition you had these other books in authority, but it wasn't Koveya until after him.
The earliest attestation of a canon, a Jewish canon, is in Flavius, like Josephus Flavius. At the end of the first century, he says, well, we have 22 books. And he doesn't name them. He said, like, we have five books of the Lord, and we have, I think, 12 prophetic books, and then we have, you know, poems, and, you know, so, but he has a number in mind. Of course, 22 is the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. So it says something that, no, but, so, it shows that at his time, there are at least some groups. Well, we know that the Sadducees, they said there are the five books of Moses, and these are the ones that have authority. And the Samaritans, the same thing. So we have evidence that for some Jewish groups, they insist that only five books have authority. They are God's word, or God's, you know, Torah, the instruction of God, God's, you know. And then we have evidence at the end of the first century that other people had a larger canon. But of course, the first time we have the list of books is in the Talmud, right? So the Talmud then in where you have the names, the actual names of the books that are in the Bible, in the rabbinical Bible. So of course it's a process. And then we have evidence that rabbis are discussing what do we do with Esther, for example. God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. So what about Song of Songs? You know, what about Ben Sira? You know. And then they discuss, you know, what do we do? You know, so we know that there were some discussions about some of the books. What do we do with them? Do we keep them? Are they canonical? Of course, they don't use the term canonical. They will say that, like, do they? I forgot the English word. You know, do you have to clean your hands? Are they souillé in French? To how do you say that? To the opposite of to be clean. To be clean is to be. You know, when you have to cleanse, is because you're. Yeah. So do they render the hands unclean? Yeah, and then you have to wash your hands. You know, so that's the terminology that the rabbis use to discuss whether a book is canonical or not. That is, if a book is scripture, if it's canonical, that is, you have all those purity laws that, you know, you cannot handle the books like any other books, right? So that's how this. But we have discussions. In the first century CE, among the rabbis, so, and then they had the Talmud, so mid first millennium, when they say, well, you know, this is the list, right? So now discussion is over. But, you know, the rabbis discuss that. And,
So the decision of what is in canon was much later in the Talmudic?
So, in the Talmud, you have the first record. So we know by the time of the Talmud, This there's no more discussion. So basically, in some Jewish tradition, they said that in Yavne, you know, around the year 90, there was a gathering and they voted or decided or whatever. But again, there's no historical evidence that this really took place. And actually, we have evidence to the contrary, because we have evidence that rabbis discuss what do we do with this book. So if indeed they had all come to an agreement at Yavne in the year 90, then why? Then there's no more discussion. So, from what we can tell.
One second, though, when the Talmud was edited much later, but it's quoting Tanoim, it's quoting people near that period of time at Yavne.
Yeah, but you also have this mention that rabbis, not only the Tanaim, are discussing what do we do with the Book of Esther, with Ben Sira, and, you know, so we have evidence that even within Rabbinical Judaism, there were discussions in the second and third centuries CE. So I would say the decision, final decision, was probably made around the second or third centuries CE. And then, of course, by the time of the Talmud, because, like, for instance, in the Mishnah, there is no evidence of a list. The list comes in the Talmud. So I would say it's somewhere between Mishnah and Talmud. Yeah. But again, we lack clear evidence. So,
well, I think the determining factor here, are they quoting to Noam or Amorim? If they're quoting Amorim, then it's a bit later. If they're quoting to Noam, then it's a bit earlier.
Yeah. So it's somewhere around that time period. Yeah,
that's. Tanaim
somewhere, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. So for now, it's difficult to pinpoint. We would need more evidence. I'd be glad if in archaeological excavations, for instance, we would find a manuscript from that time period that would record like a decision or something. So maybe in the future, hopefully in the future, we can have a better, narrow the range. But for now, it's. But as for sure is that at the time when it's translated, that is before Christian era, this was not settled. I mean, there were a huge variety between different Jewish communities as to which books have authority. There's a consensus that the books of Moses have authority. I would say everybody agrees, the five books of Moses, there's no discussion.
The prophets was not sure.
But yeah, then some people would say yes, some people would say no.
The research that I looked at, it seemed to me you had a pretty much almost a consensus, not a complete consensus, but already by the time of the Anshei Knesset Gedola, which was pretty early, earlier than Yavne, you had most of the books, and then there were a few questions about whether Ben Sira, and that already was around by the Council of the Ninth.
Yeah, yeah. So like I said, you have Flavius Josephus, so around the year 90, who says we have like 22 books, which is not the same number, but again, depends if you count like Samuel Kings as one. I mean, so he doesn't give the names. So we cannot know, like the same thing with the 12 minor prophets. Is this only one book, the book of the 12? Or so he only gives numbers, but at least he refers to a tradition that at the time, at least in some groups of Judaism, they had come to some sort of agreement. But yeah, so it's
it wasn't complete agreement.
Yeah.
Mostly.
And again, it refers to some groups of Judaism, not all of them. So yeah, there were.
Okay, from Judaism to Christianity, yeah. The parting of the ways. So we are looking forward, and you will answer Sana's question, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
You will have a Hebrew background to the New Testament.
So, to sum up what we said, at the time of Jesus, there are Greek-speaking Jews throughout the Mediterranean Sea, and not only far away, but even here in Judea, Jews read Greek, speak Greek, translate Hebrew books into Greek, biblical books and other books, and they even compose literary works, religious texts, in Greek. So it's not unusual, it's not surprising that a Jew would decide to write a religious text within Judaism in Greek. It is part of Judaism. Greek should not be seen as a language foreign to Judaism. It is one of the languages of Judaism at the time.
Which religious text is written in Greek that predates Christianity?
Well, the Book of Maccabees, for instance. And you have among the Dead Sea Scrolls, I can refer you to a book that tells the story of Moses and the Exodus that's written in Greek, so a rewriting, I would say, of some of the stories of the patriarchs that was written in Greek. And there are a number of what we would call apocryphal literature written in Greek. And there comes Jesus. As far as we know, Jesus spoke rather Aramaic. This is, I mean, even in the Gospels, you don't have to look very far. In the Gospels, when Jesus speaks, and there are actual quotes, it's usually in Aramaic, you know, Talita Kumi, you know, he says, you know, Eli Eli Lema Sabachthani, things that, words that Jesus says, you know, when he heals someone, when he's on the cross, and then you have quotation marks, and then there is Aramaic. So, the language that Jesus grew up with was probably Aramaic, which is not surprising because, again, if we do archaeological excavations, especially in Galilee, and you know, most of the inscriptions are in Aramaic. But we also have a lot of Greek inscriptions, and we even have bilingual inscriptions, Aramaic and Greek. So, obviously, Jesus, like many others, had no problem speaking Greek. Latin is another question. You know, sometimes people, when Jesus speaks to the Roman governor, Pontius Pilatus, or I don't know how to call that in English. Pilate, yeah. Maybe they spoke Latin together. Well, I wouldn't be that sure about that, because Latin is almost absent here. I mean, if you look in the inscriptions, very few. You have a few Latin inscriptions, of course, like if you go to Caesarea, and then you have the residence of Pilate, and then you have a nice inscription that Pontius Pilate, you know, was the prefectus in Latin, is the term, that he was a governor of Judea, and then you have the Latin inscriptions. So, of course, you do have a few monumental Latin inscriptions, but everything that pertains to daily life and trade and everything was usually in Greek. Likewise, for instance, if you look at coins, just a few decades before Jesus was born, we have coins that are both sided, and one side is in Aramaic, and the other side of the coin is in Greek, and it's the same coin. It says the same thing, right? One side Aramaic, one side Greek. So it's just to let you know that, you know, to change a bit the mentality that people have, that we usually think, you know, Judaism equals Hebrew and Christianity equals Greek. This is not the case. Greek is a language of Judaism, even here at the time of Jesus. It doesn't mean that Jesus spoke Greek and was teaching in Greek, and that all like the sermons or the speeches were in Greek. I don't think so. I think he spoke Aramaic, but I also think he knew Greek very well, and the same was true for his disciples. Disciples knew Greek very well and were able to write in Greek. And there you have books that are written by Jewish disciples of Jesus. These are Jewish disciples of Jesus. They think that Jesus is the Messiah. Of course, not everybody agrees with that. Other people say, no, he's not. And, you know, so, but, you know, and other people who could be the Messiah. There are different peoples that are Messiahs in the sense at that time. And one of these candidates, I would say, is Jesus from Nazareth. And he has disciples. And his disciples, they write books. And this is what we know as the New Testament. And it came to us in Greek. And now the question is, well, but did they really write those books in Greek? Isn't that possible that they wrote in another language, like Hebrew or Aramaic, because they were Jews, after all? So it would be surprising that Jews would write in Greek. And maybe those books were later translated into Greek. So, there are testimonies, there's especially one testimony from the 4th century CE, so it's 300 years after Christ. People said, well, the Gospel of Matthew was actually originally written in Hebrew letters. So we don't know if it's Hebrew language or Aramaic language, because they use the same script. But anyway, so written either Hebrew or Aramaic, and then was translated into Greek. Aha, so we would have the original gospel, the real story of Jesus, in Hebrew or Aramaic. And then, nowadays, people will tell you, we have the Bible in Aramaic. Churches from Syria, actually even here, of course, in Jerusalem, you have Syriac churches, and their liturgy is still in Syriac, that is in Aramaic. And they will tell you, we have, like, you know, even the prayers of Jesus in Aramaic, and we have the entire Bible, including the New Testament, in Aramaic. And now there's a trend that, like, for instance, I see a few years ago, people translated that into French. And they said, now we have the New Testament into French, translated from the Aramaic, not from the Greek. So it must be better. Well, it's not that simple. Actually, the Aramaic language that those people were, I can show you a picture from a Syriac, let's say, gospel. You'll see how it looks like. Like here, for instance. So you see the script, it's different from the script that you use now in everyday life. It has the same ancestor, right? It's the same alphabet, but that evolved differently in different parts. So it is Aramaic, It is Aramaic spoken in Syria, so it's another dialect of Aramaic. It's not the same Aramaic that Jesus and his disciples spoke. There are plenty of words that are common, but sometimes there are a few differences. The verbs are usually the same, the conjugation is usually the same, but not exactly the same. For instance, I'll give you an example, well, not in Aramaic, but Hebrew, because you probably knew Hebrew better than Aramaic, but let's say, if you say, he will write, you will say, Yichtov, for instance, with a Yod, and the Yod, as first letter, says, is the third person masculine singular, right? He will write. If I say Echtov, I will write, right? Yichtov, so the first letter indicates which person, right? Is that clear for everyone? Yeah, okay, well. Well, so in Aramaic, it's about the same. The initial letter tells you the person, and the third person masculine singular is also a Yud in Aramaic. In Aramaic here, in Jewish Aramaic, what we call Jewish-Palestinian Aramaic, JPA. But in Syria, they use a Nun for the third person masculine singular, which may be confusing because the Nun, we thought it's we, like first person plural, right? We, right, you see? So there are differences like that. It's not big differences, but you can tell if someone is using a Yud or a Nun as the first letter, you can say, oh, he's from here or from here, right? So there are a few differences in the Aramaic dialect. It's not exactly the same dialect. So this is not the Aramaic Bible like that people think was originally written by the disciples of Jesus and then translated into Greek. This is another dialect of Aramaic. So now people might say, yes, okay, it's another dialect, but they just adapted it. They adapted it to this Syriac dialect. So Syriac versus the other one we call this Jewish Palestinian Aramaic, JPA. Say Palestinian because there's also Jewish Babylonian Aramaic, right? So that's the term that's used by scholars, say JPA and you know and everything. So you have dictionaries of like Sokolov, who's a teacher at Tel Aviv University, has all those Aramaic dictionaries. So the question is, maybe the Syriac version. Oh, you don't see it on the yeah. Maybe the Syriac version is just a slight adaptation from the Aramaic of Jesus to the Aramaic of those believers. Well, it's not that simple again. Because, you see, I said earlier, there are passages when Jesus, I'll show you on the screen. I'll show you. Wait, I'm just launching a passage. I'll take an example when Jesus speaks I put this, well, that's a bit, I'll open a new window because otherwise it's too crowded. Here on the screen so that you can see, this is just a Bible software. And so there's this passage where Jesus, let me check, for instance, where Jesus said Talita, let's look at that verse, for instance. Like Mark 5, 41, he took her by the hand and said to her, Talita cum, which means girl, little girl, get up. Now, you see that verse, for instance, you have, if I look at the Greek now, I'll put the Greek, you don't have to know Greek, I'll just let you know how it works, is that, and I can write bigger also so it's easier to see. So in the Greek text that we have, so this is an English translation based on the Greek text. So, and you have it's all in Greek, except that those two words, talita cum, they are just transliterating into the Greek alphabet what is Aramaic. And then, which is then, little girl get up, right? Now, if you speak Aramaic, you don't need to know what it means, right? So, if you have an Aramaic version of the original Aramaic version of that verse would have been, Jesus took her by the hand and said to her, Talita kum, and that's it. You don't need to explain. If you know Aramaic, you don't need to be told. You know. But what happens is that, so by when we looked for Aramaic manuscripts of the New Testament, we found those Syriac manuscripts. And in those Syriac manuscripts, we found evidence that the Syriac was translated from the Greek. Because there are places like the Greek quotes the Aramaic, translates it, and uses another term. Or there are, and then you find this in the Syriac. In the Syriac, you find even Greek loan words. They will use, for instance, namusa, the Torah, Torah, Hebrew Torah, is translated nomos in Greek. It's a Greek word.
Just ask you this Syriac manuscript, when are they from?
Aha.
How old are they?
So, good question. Those Syriac manuscripts, we have old manuscripts. We have Syriac manuscripts that are only, let's say, 200 or 300 years after Jesus. So it's quite early. It's not the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament we have. We have a few fragments from the 2nd century CE. There's the famous, for instance, John Ryland's. I'll show you the picture.
From the internet or from your computer?
No, I'm on the internet right now. So, yeah. Like, for instance, if you look at this small piece of papyrus, this is two pictures. You know, it's on both sides, you know. This one side, the other side. So this tiny piece of papyrus is one of the oldest preserved fragments of the New Testament, right? It's in Greek. And it's from the 2nd century CE, like 100 years after Jesus. Which is not that bad, because usually there's a long period of time between the time that people supposedly composed a book or wrote a book and the earliest manuscript. If you think of Greek literature like Homer, for instance, or Herodotus, or those famous Greek writers, we say, well, they wrote that book, I don't know, like 500 years BCE. Except that the earliest manuscripts we have are usually 1,000 years later. So it's not unusual to have 1,000 years between the date that the book was supposedly written and the earliest preserved fragments we have. And usually the fragments are only tiny fragments, you know, not nice scrolls. It's rather exceptional to say, well, somebody wrote something and we have a manuscript that's only 100 years after. This is very unusual, you know. So we are very lucky to have sometimes like pieces of fragments, and there's a new fragment like this that was published a few months ago of the Gospel of Mark, so another of the Gospels, and it's also probably around the same period of time from the 2nd century CE, so like 100 years before, after the events. So it's remarkable that we have. But of course, these are tiny. If you want nicer, complete manuscripts, you have to wait for a few centuries. Like, for instance, one of the earliest complete Greek manuscript is what we call the Codex Vaticanus. There you have a picture, and it's from the 4th century CE, right? So it's basically 300 years after the events. Which is not that bad, by the way. It's quite good also that we have a complete Greek Bible from that time. And it's a nice codex, so leaves of parchment on top of each other, and with three columns, you can see. It's really nice. But so the question is, you know, okay, we have those Greek Bibles, and the assumption is that all those books were written in Greek, but like I said, some people thought, you know, it doesn't make sense. The disciples of Jesus, they would write in Hebrew or in Aramaic, you know, why would they write in Greek? So there is this idea that maybe some of the books, at least maybe some of the Gospels, were written in Aramaic. But if you go to the Syriac, there's also one of the earliest Syriac Bible is the Codex Sinaiticus in Syriac. Because there's one in Greek, but there's one in Syriac also. It was found in the it was found in the St. Catherine Monastery in the Sinai Peninsula. So you have a picture of this, and this is the Book of Matthew. This is the beginning of the Book of Matthew.
So, like I said, some people thought maybe this is the original Gospel of Matthew written in Aramaic before it was translated into Greek. But like I said, you know, this dialect is Syriac dialect. It's not the same Aramaic dialect as Jesus. So then people looked for, what about manuscripts of the New Testament, not in Syriac Aramaic, but here in Jewish Aramaic or Jewish Palestinian Aramaic. So here we found what we call Christian Palestinian Aramaic text, CPA. Ah, you don't have to switch. Yeah. So manuscripts coming not from Syria, but here from Palestine, from Judea. When I use Palestine, I just use it as a geographical term from antiquity. It has nothing to do with modern day politics. So from the region, then we have, and the Aramaic of those Gospels is the local Aramaic. Remember I told you earlier, like, the difference between Yud and Nun as the performative of, you know, the verb, you know. The dialect here is the same. We have here the local dialect. And so people thought, oh, that's it. Now we have the Gospel in its original version. So I'll show you how it looks like. Christian Palestinian Aramaic. Alright, you have an example here. No, but this is not. Yeah, that's not it. It becomes more difficult on. Yeah, this one would be good. Except you have to look beneath it. Okay. Some of those manuscripts are difficult to decipher because they were erased and reused after. It's recycling. Mm-hmm. So actually, on a lot of those manuscripts, if you look, if you don't pay attention, the text you see, for instance, is a much later text in Syriac or in Arabic. But if you look at the traces, you can see that there was a first manuscript and somebody washed it to reuse it. So I'm trying to find a better picture that you could see how it looks like, but I'm not sure I can find. What about this one? I wanted you to see how the script looked like, but yes, here you can see a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like in black, you have the newer manuscript, but in the background here, in much bigger letters, you see the older manuscript. So this is a manuscript. So somebody wrote this, then somebody washed it and wrote, you know, in front of it the new text, right? So don't look at the black ink, look at this reddish ink. This is what we call Christian Palestinian Aramaic. Now if you look at it, you're like it doesn't, the script does not look at all like the Aramaic of that Jesus used and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so it's not Jewish Palestinian Aramaic, it's Christian Palestinian Aramaic. So when does it date from? It dates from 500 years after Jesus. So when people said, oh, now we have the Aramaic version of the New Testament, of the Gospel, written by followers of Jesus here in the land, I say, well, wait for a minute. It's 500 years later. And the script looks more like Syriac than the square script used by the Jews. So it means that those people clearly identified themselves as Christians and not as Jews. And then again, if I go back to that verse that I talked to you about, like when Jesus, you know, takes the girl by the hand and he says Talita kumi, and, you know, which means little girl, get up. In those manuscripts, it's really funny because you have it in Aramaic, like Jesus said to her, Talita kumi, which means Talita kumi, because of course it's in Aramaic, so
there's no way to say it otherwise in Aramaic.
But kumi also in Hebrew is pizkera.
Oh yeah, yeah. Of course, kum. La kum is also in Hebrew. It's in most. But talita is Aramaic. Yeah. So they repeat themselves twice in the same verse, right? Also, when they talk about Jesus, they don't write Yeshua, like in Aramaic. They write Jesus, like Yud Samech Vav Samech, which is the Greek version of the name of Jesus. So it's really funny, you read an Aramaic text, and instead of having Jesus written as Yeshua, you have Jesus. And also, when he speaks Aramaic, and you have the translation, Jesus said to her, you know, Talita Kumi, which means Talita Kumi. It's what happens, you know. So again, it's clear evidence that even this, what we call Christian, Palestinian, Aramaic Gospels are also translated from the Greek. So the evidence we have right now really points to the fact that the Gospels were written in Greek. Or if there was an Aramaic version, it was translated into Greek very quickly. How do I know that? Is that okay? Am I speaking too fast? No? It's okay? Okay. Well, so that's another proof, another element in the demonstration. If you put side by side the Gospels, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you have four Gospels in the New Testament. Sometimes they tell you the same story, which is fine. I mean, they all talk, each one of them tells the story of Jesus. Yeah, okay, good. And they won't tell the famous story of Jesus who will, for instance, multiply, you know, the fish and the bread, you know. Like, they don't have large crowds, they want to eat. Well, we don't have food, there's only this guy, this small boy, he has, you know, some fish and bread. And Jesus will perform a miracle, and they can feed thousands of people. And you find the same story. Sometimes there are differences, details here and there, and so on. Sometimes the text is exactly the same. Like, you can do copy and paste. You have entire verses that you can compare between, especially between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John sometimes is more different, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke, some of the verses are exactly the same in Greek. Right? In Greek. And that's my point. So, if the text is the same in Greek, it's not just that, for instance, you had oral tradition, let's say, you know, well, Jesus did this, and, you know, I'm going to tell you the story, you know. Let's say we all go to a party and we all witness something, and then we will all write our own account of what happened. Everybody will end up with a different account, you know.
But I have a question. It's interesting that it's the same Greek, but even the more major differences, like some Gospels don't mention the virgin birth and others do.
Of course.
So then that would mean there's even a greater difference between us. And how can you rely on the similarity in Greek?
Aha, that's a very interesting question, but that's okay. But now we're like, you're talking more about what they wanted to write about, right? So that's a very good question, but it's better if we discuss it after, because now what I'm discussing is the question of an original Aramaic gospel versus Greek gospel. So I'm focusing on that. But we can talk about it later. But now I'm trying to show how early the Greek version was. So let's say if they write independently, they would not come up with the same story, you know, with the same wording and everything. If you have the exact same wording, it means it's a copy and paste, you know, like you do on your computer, select and copy and paste. And it shows that they have a common source, and the common source is a written source, not oral source. And also, it's a written source, and it's also a written source in Greek. Now, of course, there are so, by the way, this question is called, we discuss synoptic gospels, or synoptic verses, like synoptic verses, gospels. Sometimes people talk about the synoptic problem because they see it as a problem. So sometimes let's discuss the synoptic problem. So this refers to the fact when we talk about the the synoptic passages is those passages that are told almost exactly, sometimes exactly the same, sometimes not, but you find the same story several times in the Gospels. But the fact that you have some of the verse, some verses that are identical in Greek shows that so these Gospels have a common source, so a common Greek source. And scholars refer to it as Q, because there are German scholars and they use the term Quelle in German, which means the source. So they said, let's talk about Q. So when you hear people talk about the gospel, the Q gospel, which, you know, it's the source gospel, you know. And there have been all sorts of fascinating theories that are also sometimes very creative and not very scientific, of people thinking, you know, some people, anyway. So people have been looking for this source.
So Q is in Greek, not in Hebrew.
And yes, Q has to be in Greek because you have exact wording, common, copy and paste, in the Greek. So it has to be Greek. So some people said, well, maybe Matthew is the source. Like, you know, Matthew wrote a gospel. And then others, like other gospels like Luke, Mark, and maybe John, and, you know, they used Matthew, and they copied and pasted something, then they also added some other things, and, you know, they did their own gospel based on Matthew. So Matthew would be the source. And then people said, no, it's not Matthew, it's Mark. Mark is the source gospel, and the other gospels, they used Mark to write their own gospel. And so, and some people come up with very complex theories. I'm not going to go into all those theories, but whatever the situation, Q, whether it's Matthew, Mark, something else, has to be in Greek. Because there are exact verses, identical verses, or passages even, in the Greek language. So, now, if you think, let's say, Matthew is Q, then, of course, it's possible that Matthew first wrote in Aramaic or Hebrew, then was translated into Greek, and then the Greek version was used by Luke, Mark, John, and others. Why not? It's possible. But if it's the case, it means that the Greek version appeared very quickly. But it's not like 100 years or 200 years after that, you know, that Q was translated into Greek. Personally, I don't see why there wouldn't be a gospel written in Aramaic by the disciples of Jesus very quickly. You know, these are it's the same time as the Dead Sea Scrolls. So thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know what was going on here in Judea, how people wrote, what was the writing techniques, how many people could read and write. You know, we have a good idea now, a much better idea of what was going on at the time here. And what we see is that, yes, a lot of Jews knew how to read and write. And they knew how to prepare papyrus or parchment. Usually papyrus was imported from Egypt, but parchment could be prepared here. And a lot of people know, and I don't see why the disciple of Jesus would not want to write anything. It doesn't make sense. Of course, very quickly, they wanted to write down something about their Messiah. So, and I would still think that because they use Aramaic most of them as their mother language, it would make sense, and probably because Jesus was teaching in Aramaic most of the time, it would make sense to write a gospel in Aramaic. So I'm still hopeful that maybe one day we will find a manuscript of an Aramaic gospel, contemporary to the Dead Sea Scrolls perhaps. That would be some kind of very early gospel written by the disciples of Jesus in Judea or in Galilee, and there is evidence in later sources that there is a gospel of the Aramaic speaking disciples of Jesus, those that were called the Nazarenes, you know, the Notzrim. The term is still used today in modern Hebrew to designate this group of people, the Notzrim. So This is the group of the Aramaic-speaking disciples of Jesus in Judea and in Galilee.
You mean direct disciples or disciples of disciples?
No. Even the first generation, they use the term. The term Nazarene is used already in the first century CE?
The Nazarene Church. That can make up of the first disciples, or that's like...
No, no, it is the first disciples of the Jews. That's how they call themselves. Jesus is called a Nazarene, and his disciples are called Nazarene. At the time, the word Christian does not exist. The word Christian is invented later. I'll come to it actually in a minute. So,
and that's before the Ebionites.
It's before, yeah.
Just before
the Ebionites, just before. So you have the disciples of Jesus. They speak Aramaic. There's no reason why they would not write anything in Aramaic. At the same time, they also speak Greek very well, much better than people thought, you know. So it's not like people used to say, oh, there's no way that the apostles could write Greek, perhaps Paul, but, you know, because he grew up in Tarsus and so. But the others, oh, John, Peter, and no, they wouldn't be able to, and they wouldn't be interested anyway in writing in Greek. That's not true. So maybe there was a gospel written in Aramaic very early by the first generation of disciples of Jesus. Why not? I would be very happy if we found a manuscript. And if we find one someday, I'll be the first to study it and publish it and say, hey, you know, good news. But so far, we do not have this Aramaic, right? So when people tell, yes, we have, like, and they show you a Syriac manuscript or a Christian Palestinian Aramaic manuscript, that's not it. Very early, so if there was a gospel in Aramaic, it was translated very quickly into Greek. In the first years, I would say, you know, a few years later only, not 100 years after. It was very quickly translated into Greek.
How do you know so quick?
Because of the other gospels. Like I said, the source Q, the source of the synoptic gospels, is in Greek. And those gospels...
Well, how do you know the date of that Greek?
Oh, but because those other gospels are written in the first century CE, right? So if those gospels are written in the first century CE, and if their source is already in Greek,
50 years later, though,
it could be 50 years later, but not 100 years later. That's what I said. You know, like it cannot be 100 years later. It has to be within the generation, like, you know, of the disciples, and it, you know, it goes quickly. You don't have to wait for 100 years. That's my idea. I said 100 years because the idea is when everybody's dead. You know, when I told the story earlier with my great-grandmother who speaks German, you know, after three or four generations, you know, traditions are, you know, they're too much distance to check. But if someone is alive, or I knew someone who was alive, you know, then you can keep the tradition much more in check. So that's why I'm interested in what's going on in the first century CE. In the second century CE, it gets more difficult to check, you know, to do fact-checking. And so in the first century CE already, there very well may have been a gospel written in Aramaic, but we don't have it. Maybe we'll find it. And what's for sure is that the source of the gospels that we have in the New Testament is in Greek, Q, because of this copy-paste. And then the other Aramaic versions we have been translated to Aramaic from the Greek. So in Syriac and Christian Palestinian Aramaic. So that's basically what I wanted to tell you about that. Now, what happens next is that why the question is, okay, the disciples know Aramaic, but they also know Greek. They do business, they travel. Greek is an international language. It's not seen as a language that is foreign to Judaism. You can be a Jew in Judea, in Galilee, and you can write in Greek, no problem. So that's also a reason why a lot of disciples decided to write in Greek, because there were actually a lot of Jews who did not know Hebrew and Aramaic. Remember what we said in the first part about the Septuagint and the Jewish communities in Alexandria and throughout the Mediterranean Sea? There are a number of Jews. We have Jews in Rome, we have Jews even in Corsica, in Spain, and, you know, we have evidence of Jews who do not know Hebrew or Aramaic. So now, if you have found the Messiah, and you say Jesus is the Messiah that the Jews have been waiting for, and you want to share the good news, say, hey guys, hello from Judea, we want to let you know that we have excellent news. The Messiah that we've been waiting for, we found him. It's Jesus. Yeshua, HaMashiach, Yeshua HaNotzri. So, and they said, of course, if you want to reach a maximum number of Jews, not only in Judea or in Galilee, but throughout the world. Well, you have this vast majority of Jews who only speak Greek. So it's only natural to write in Greek. And that's what happens with a number of, so the Gospels, like I said, that maybe they have an Aramaic source, but then the immediate source Q is in Greek. And they write in Greek, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's why we have them in Greek. The epistles, the rest of the New Testament, all of those books are written in Greek, in the Greek language, so that they could reach out to a maximum number of Jews. Now, of course, very quickly, a question will rise about, maybe there are people who are not Jews, but would still be interested in knowing about the Messiah. I mean, if Jesus is the savior of everyone, you know, that you can see, you know, like even Abraham's promise in Genesis chapter 12, that all the families of the world will be blessed in you. So the God's promise for the world is for all the world, all the families of the world, not just the Jews. So we also want to share the good news with other people. So again, Greek makes sense. If you write in Greek, not only you can reach all of the Jews, if you write in Aramaic, you reach the Jews in Judea, the Jews in Babylonia, you know, but that's it. If you write in Greek, those Jews also know Greek, so no problem. All the Jews know Greek, and you also reach all the Jews who did not know Hebrew or Aramaic. And plus you can reach all the non-Jews who might be interested to hear about the God of the Bible and his Messiah, Yeshua. And that's why all of the Greek scriptures, all of the New Testament is written in Greek. Now, this sounds like a good idea at first. And it works, actually. It is a good idea, because this movement, the Jesus movement, will spread very quickly. A few decades, and people hear about it all the way in Rome, right? So throughout the Roman Empire, people hear about it. Not only Jews, but also non-Jews. And so, this might seem strange. Also, why would non-Jews be interested in the Jewish Messiah? You know, they have another religion. Well, if you look at what's going on, let's say in Rome, there is evidence in Rome that the Romans were interested in the Jewish religion. Like, oh, this is a fascinating religion. We don't understand it. Like, they were, how to say that? The Greek and the Roman religions, they had plenty of gods. They had a pantheon. And those had plenty of stories with those gods and statues and, you know, and their gods were, let's say, very human in a way. And a lot of them, because they had philosophers and thinkers, they said, but do you really think that the gods are like that? You know, maybe we made the gods into our own image. And, you know, so people were distancing themselves from the traditional Greek and Roman religion. And especially the philosophers, they were interested by this one tiny religion, Judaism, that they didn't understand well. Like they said, what, you have only one God? Like, it's fast. Why? Why do you have only one? You can have plenty of gods. You have only one. Okay, what does he look like? Nothing? You don't even have a statue? So they had this idea of this only one God, invisible God. And they thought, maybe the Jews, they understand better, after all, because, you know, their God is really different from the humans, right? So they were fascinated, especially the philosophers. So we have evidence that at the time of Jesus, a lot, especially in the high society of Greek cities and Roman cities, a lot of people were attracted to Judaism. They were fascinated. They thought, you know, they have this pure, abstract conception of the divine, which seems so much purer than, you know, our idea of all those gods fighting and so Judaism was already popular in certain circles. Of course, they couldn't, a lot of them couldn't say, well, I want to convert to Judaism, because, you know, of course, if you're Roman or Greek, I mean, you have to keep the traditional religion. But they even have like kind of secret meetings, and they wanted to know more about Judaism. So of course, if they already have an interest in Judaism, and somebody comes to them and say, you know, in Judaism we have decided that the Messiah is coming, God is sending his Messiah, and what we have found this Messiah, and his name is Yeshua, and they say, oh, tell us more about him.
The name of
the philosopher. Oh, well, let's say, well, you know, if even Roman officials, they would marry. They would have Jewish wives, you know. Like again, even Nero, Titus, you know, it's quite commonplace. If you go to Rome, you can see a number of people, even emperors, generals, emperors, that actually are married to Jews.
Yeah, but the relationship going between.
Oh, then look at Philo of Alexandria, for instance. It's the easiest way. He will.
He's pre-Rome.
Well, the time Roman Empire starts 30 BCE, so he's within the Roman Empire at the beginning, but that's the time of Jesus, I would say. And he uses Neoplatonicism to see the idea of the Logos, for instance. If you think of the Greek concept, the Greek philosophical concept of the Logos, which is this abstract, pure revelation, divine revelation, then he will apply it and say, well, it's God, you know. So basically, you have also non-Jews interested in Judaism and in the Messiah, in Jesus. And then you have all this Greek literature that's ready for them. They look at it. We have the story of Yeshua in Greek. You can read it for yourself. And so this literature becomes very popular. So it works. It's a good idea. But then, and that's the last stage of the story, after the destruction of the temple in 70, it's a big shock, of course, for Judaism. And a lot of Jewish movements don't survive, or hardly survive. Like, for instance, the Sadducees. The Sadducees, they were controlling the temple. Well, you don't have a temple, they lose their power. The Essenes, or some messianic movements, they're waiting for the Messiah. Well, you have those who have found the Messiah, like Jesus, and others who wait. They will wait a bit longer, like when Bar Kokhba comes in the early 2nd century, they think, oh, he might be the Messiah. That's why they call him Bar Kokhba. Kokhba is the star. That's not his real name. So they give him this nickname to say he's the son of the star. So he's basically coming from heaven. He's the Messiah. What? Yeah. So, and then it doesn't work because Bar Kokhba, then the Romans came again and they destroyed. So all those messianic movements, a lot of them, they lose hope and they say, well, maybe we were wrong. So the Essenes, they will disappear. A lot of movements will almost completely disappear. And two movements will basically survive. Those who say, but we have found the Messiah, and that's Jesus, Yeshua. So this movement is alive and well. And the movement that says, even if we don't have the temple, we have the Torah, and we can focus on the study of the Torah, and that's what becomes rabbinical Judaism. And these are the two main movements within Judaism that will survive. But then they become competitors in a way, right? And there will be an interesting phenomenon of emancipation, of separation. And each of those movements will make sure that we don't confuse the two. Like, no, we have nothing to do with each other. For instance, the disciples of Jesus will say, we will no longer meet on Saturday, on Shabbat. We will meet on Sunday. So we don't see each other. Of course, I mean, if you come to the synagogue on the same day, you say, hello, how are you doing? You know, up till now, you know, of course, Jews would meet, whether they believe that Jesus is the Messiah or not. They're still Jews. So they would meet together. Even in Rome, we have evidence in the first century CE that they would share even the necropolis, the tombs. They would, you know, in a cemetery, they had tombs, Jews and that believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and Jews that believed that Jesus was not the Messiah. Well, they were still Jews, you know. According to Roman law, it was just Judaism, right? But later on, so at the end of the first century CE, beginning of the second century CE, you can see that they split. So there will be a few things that will focus on to artificially, in a way, distance themselves from each other. So meeting day, like we meet on Saturday, on Friday night, I mean on Shabbat, on the seventh day, and no, we meet on the first day. Yeah, so then, you know, different. And then the focus, of course, of the study. Rabbis will say we need to study the Torah and pass on the tradition. We have this oral tradition, so you have the birth of the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the Midrashim. You have all this literature that is basically, we want to make sure that people understand the Torah. And the Torah becomes the focus of most of their discussions. Whereas others...
It wasn't the focus before?
Well, as long as you had a temple, I would say the temple was a central piece of religion. Even at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have the temple scroll, you can see that the temple was something central to religion at the time. Of course the Torah is important, of course everybody agrees that the Torah is important, but I would say now there's the Torah tells you, for instance, how to do the sacrifices.
Now, I think you always have the Torah, but you have the lack of the temple now, so
yep.
Therefore you have what was remaining, which
yep.
was the Torah.
Yep. Yeah, that's my point. So But the disciples of Jesus will say we want to focus on Jesus, and so then they have all those Christological discussions, like who was Jesus, was he God or not, or divine, but if he's God, there's several gods, no, there's only one God. So all those discussions about who Jesus is and what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah, the Son of God, and everything. So you have all this literature, huge literature about that, whereas in rabbinical circles, the huge literature is around the Torah. So you can see that, and then the Christians will say, no, we don't care about the Torah. You even have people in the mid-second century CE who say, we don't care at all about the Torah. Now we have Jesus. Why do you want to care about, you know, what Moses said? Well, you have Jesus, you know. So you even have people who advocate that we shouldn't pay attention to it at all. And then the language comes here. They say, oh, but those guys, you know, they speak Hebrew, you know, but we have Greek. And they say, you know, Greek is superior to Hebrew, so we don't care about Hebrew. And on the other hand, rabbis will say, Greek is not a good language, you cannot use Greek. And then they have discussions about, you know, what it, let's say Aramaic is okay, you know, you can have a Targum, that is an Aramaic translation. Of course, it doesn't have the same authority as Hebrew, but it's okay in a synagogue to, you read the Hebrew and then you can read the Aramaic. It's okay to use an Aramaic translation, even though it's only a translation, you can still use it and it doesn't replace the Hebrew text, but it's okay. But a Greek translation, they don't want to hear about it. And
but then they didn't like, and eventually they did not like the Septuagint, and they made a fast day that the Torah was translated in Greek. But I believe in later, rabbinically, they created a Greek translation. It's written in the Talmud, actually.
Another Greek translation? Ah, yes. So, of course, They are corrections of the Greek translation to make it closer to the Hebrew. And so we have that. We actually have manuscripts that confirm that. Already in the first century CE, actually, there are, like in Nachal Chever, there's a Greek manuscript of the 12 minor prophets, and this Greek manuscript is more like a word-for-word translation of the Hebrew. Like, when you have vegam in Hebrew, they have kaige in Greek, which makes nonsense in Greek. Or when you have et, that introduces the direct object, they translate as sun in Greek, which means with, because, you know, et in Hebrew also means with, you know, it's two different words, like iti means with me, but oti means me, like a direct object. But anyway, so they are these weird Greek translations that are trying to align the Greek with the received Hebrew text. But even this stops, this goes on, like, you know, it's already first century. And then a little bit second century, but already by the third century CE, rabbis do not want to hear about Greek anymore. And this will even impact Jewish communities in Europe. If you go to Bulgaria and others, we have recently made excavations that even in the Byzantine period, so like the 300, 400 years after Jesus, you have Jewish communities that speak Greek. But they are... We were surprised when excavations were made to find those Greek communities, because they were so remote and almost forgotten at the time. A lot of Jewish literature, those books that I said were composed in Greek by Jews before the birth of Christianity, were completely lost. And they were found only, like in Christian monasteries. recently, like in the 19th century, like for 1,000 years they were forgotten, and it's only in the 18th, 19th, 20th century that this literature, this Greek literature, Jewish literature, was found again, and we realized, oh, there was such a huge production of literature in Greek by Jews even before Jesus. So not Christian literature, but really Jewish. So it shows that, and the reason is that rabbinical Judaism became normative Judaism, like when people thought, you know, there were other groups, but so tiny. The majority within Judaism became rabbinical Judaism, and all rabbinical literature is in Hebrew and in Aramaic, but not in Greek. And the Christians, a lot of them, also because, I must be honest, a lot of non-Jews were interested in believing in Jesus as the Messiah, but should I convert to Judaism? You know, I'm okay to believe in the God of the Bible, to believe in his Messiah, but I don't want to keep all the mitzvot and everything, you know. So isn't there a way that I can, you know, believe in God and his Messiah, and, you know, and I don't want to learn Hebrew or Aramaic, you know, Greek is okay, Latin is okay, but, you know, learning another language, and people said it's okay. And then, then a majority of the believers in Jesus, in the beginning, the majority were Jews, and a minority were non-Jews. And after a century, the opposite happens. A majority of them are non-Jews, and a minority of them are Jews. And once you have this switch in mind, so that's what I'm saying, in the second century, the Christians, they are very happy to distance themselves from the Jews, from Hebrew, from Aramaic, and they will say, we have Greek, and Greek is just fine. We don't need any Hebrew at all. And the rabbis are also happy to distance themselves from this group of Jews that believe that Jesus is the Messiah, also because this group is now also populated by a lot of non-Jews who don't care at all about the mitzvot, and, you know, so they said, you know, well, you know, those guys, it's another religion altogether. To the point that in the 4th century, so 300 years after Jesus and the events, when someone wants to translate the Bible into Latin, and that's Jerome, he says, okay, I will translate the Bible from the Hebrew, like, you know, the Torah, and, you know, so he goes ahead and translates into Latin, because, you know, in Rome people spoke Latin, so they said, we want to have... And he's being criticized. People say, what? Why are you translating from the Latin, from the Hebrew into Latin? He said, well, because those books, like the Torah, was written in Hebrew, right? You know? They say, well, but we don't care. What we want is the Greek version. So you translate into Latin from the Greek. Otherwise, you are kind of a Judaizer. Like, do you want to convert to Judaism? What are you doing? It's crazy. He was criticized at the time because 300 years after Jesus, people do not see their belief in God and in his Messiah as being part of Judaism. They have completely lost track of their Jewish origins. And language was very instrumental in that. They were very happy to say, you know, so the Christians said, we don't want to read anything that's in Hebrew and Aramaic. And the rabbi said, you know, the Greek, you know, it's bad anyway. We try to fix it, but it doesn't work. So we don't want to hear anything about Greek because it looks too Christian. And so we ended up with this situation where Greek looked like, oh, it's the Christian language. And Hebrew, oh, it's the Jewish language. And this has come all the way to today, I would say. Like, you know, where people would say, you know, well, you know, the Greek, you know, but it's Christian and the Hebrew is Jewish. Or, And then some people would say the reverse now. Some people would say, the gospel, we have to read it in Hebrew because Greek is not the right language. We have to find the original Aramaic language. And we discussed that at the break, you know, when you said that some people want to revert everything back to Hebrew and Aramaic and say, the true believers in Jesus, you know, because Jesus was a Jew, so no, we do not want Greek. It wasn't like that in the beginning. It wasn't like that. It was used, it's almost like the language was instrumental for people who wanted to distance themselves even in terms of religion. So that's how the Greek Bible was born, that's how it was handed on to us, and that's how it was instrumental in the separation, the artificial separation between
what is now called Christianity. It wasn't the name at the time, didn't exist at the time, and I would say the believers in Jesus as the Messiah, and those who did not believe that Jesus was the Messiah within Judaism. That's the idea.
Okay, a couple of questions. So, about two-thirds of when the New Testament is quoting the Old Testament, they're usually using, or what we have today, is the Septuagint. So my question is, was there a Septuagint hanging around that they looked into, or that was later church fathers who, when they looked at the manuscripts, they chose at that time the Septuagint?
Mm. So it's a very good question. When you see in the New Testament that they say it is written, and you have a quotation from, let's say, you know, Genesis or Deuteronomy or Psalms, sometimes, but it's more complex than that. Sometimes it conforms to both the Hebrew and Greek version, because there's no difference in the Hebrew and the Greek. Sometimes it conforms to the Greek version, when there's a difference between the Greek and the Hebrew. Sometimes it conforms to the Hebrew, and sometimes it's something else. And like, for instance, then we thought, what's going on? In a number of cases, it conforms to neither. In Paul, for instance, 1 Corinthians 14, and I worked on that, actually, and I found out that in some of those quotations, there's a third option that nobody thought about, that it was using another translation, another Greek translation, or revised Greek translation. So that's what we said earlier. Like, you know, at some point, some Jews try to fix the Greek translation to make it more in line. I refer to this scroll in Nachal Chever that dates to the time of Jesus, and the Greek is a correction or a reworking of the Greek translation to make it more in line with the with one form of the Hebrew text. This work of fixing the text, traditionally we thought it dated to the second or third centuries CE, so after Jesus, after his apostles, so because that was the tradition that had told us that. So we thought that those revisions did not exist at the time of Paul, so Paul could not have used them because they did not exist at his time, except that now, thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know that they existed at the time. This revision of the Greek translation was made earlier than we thought, and already existed at the turn of the era. So if it already existed, then the question is, maybe the authors of the New Testament knew about them and used them. And I found a couple of cases in Paul, when Paul is quoting from the Bible, that he is actually using that kind of revision. So nobody thought about it. They said, well, either he quoted from the Greek, traditional Greek translation, or he quoted from the Hebrew version and translated himself into Greek. Or third option, well, he imagined something else and his translation is not very accurate because it didn't match, you know. But now I proposed another option. No, Paul did not come up with a crazy translation. He quoted from a revision of the Greek translation because we now have evidence that it existed at the time. We have manuscripts from the area. And you know that Paul was quite a good scholar, so he probably knew about the project. If you have scholars working on a revision of the Greek version at the time, I'm sure that Paul knew about it. Maybe he was even involved. I don't know, who knows. Maybe he was working on it because he mastered both languages, you know. So that's another option. So we need now, what would need to be done is to go over all of those quotations that you find in the New Testament of Scriptures and do the same kind of, but it takes time, so it's a long project.
I like two examples. You have like Isaiah 59:20, where is the Redeemer is coming from Zion. Mm. So in the Septuagint it says to return the trouble of Israel. Mm. That's what Paul is quoted by Paul. Mm. But in the Hebrew it says the Redeemer is coming for those who will return. So it's a huge difference theology. Is the Messiah coming?
Yeah.
He's going to cause them to return, or is he calling for the ones who are returning themselves?
But in that case,
that's the Septuagint.
Yeah, so it's the Greek translation. But again, with the Dead Sea Scrolls, we now have evidence that the Greek translation is the translation of a Hebrew text
that said basically the same thing. Now, of course, the manuscript that we have are fragmentary, so we do not have, like for the book of Isaiah, we have the great Isaiah scroll, but which is not the same text type as the Greek translation, but we have other manuscripts of the book of Isaiah in Hebrew that conform to the Greek translation, and that show that the Greek translation is not the Greek translation that changed, you know, that it was already in the Hebrew. So it doesn't, when Paul quotes that verse, it doesn't mean that he's quoting from the Greek. He might also be quoting from a Hebrew manuscript that had the same text, you see? Now, of course,
other than the Masoretic.
Yeah, different than the Masoretic, yeah. Now, of course, he might also be quoting from the Greek, but also knowing from the Hebrew, you know, so we have all those options on the table that was possible at the time. And again, Paul and the other apostles were not viewing the Greek translation as bad. That's what I said in the first part of the talk this morning, is that we have the idea that the Greek, actually for centuries, we had even the idea that the Greek translation of the Bible was Christian. People even forgot that it was made centuries before Jesus and that it was Jewish literature. Even in Jewish scholarship, it's only in the 20th century that Jewish scholars, like Immanuel Tove, I told you about Immanuel Tove, he's one of the greatest scholars. He started his career not with the Dead Sea Scrolls, but with the Greek version of the Bible, the Septuagint and other Greek translations. And he's a Jew. And people said, why are you looking at that? I mean, you're a Jew, you should look at the Masoretic text. And he said, no, this Greek translation is a Jewish translation, several centuries before Jesus. It is our literature. It is not Christian literature. It is ours. It is our cultural heritage. So why should the Christian do all the work of studying it and everything? You know, this is our past, our heritage, our culture. But that's something new that Jews would say, scholars would say, you know, would claim, reclaim in a way. They are reclaiming now the Greek translation, the Septuagint, and all this Greek literature produced by Jews, saying this is our literature before it was used by the Christians. And I think that's important, this change in scholarship. It's very important.
Flusser also represents?
And Flusser, of course, yeah, of course. Yeah.
But it's interesting you say R. So I think there's a huge distinction, because when you say R, I mean it's a product of Jewish thought and civilization.
Mm.
Just because the author's Jewish does not necessarily mean it was accepted part of the tradition. You know what I'm saying?
Of course, there were different groups, and so some people were very happy with it, other people condemned it. Of course, and we know in rabbinical literature that, yes, at some point...
Like in the Talmud said the Apocrypha and the writings of the meaning, it's called Sifrei Chitzonim.
Yeah, of course. No, but clearly, in rabbinical Judaism, in the first centuries CE, after Jesus, clearly, like I said, there has been a gradual rejection of Greek literature, of Greek Jewish literature by the rabbis.
So for example, let's say Psalm 110 is a very good example. Mm-hmm. The Lord said to my Lord.
Yeah.
So in the New Testament thought, you'd say, well, who's the Lord? And it must be the Messiah. So then if you would look in the Masoretic text, you have the word Elohim, and you have the word Yekevavka, and you have the Tetragrammaton.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Septuagint does not make that distinction.
Yeah.
So, now was that from an earlier Greek trying to be closer to the Hebrew, or was that from the Septuagint, like in the Psalms?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't have any answer for that, because we would need to find a manuscript that would produce evidence. But yes, the Greek language also, in a way, the Greek translation also helped, in a way, the perception of Jesus as divine. Because, well, not only the Greek, but it's more obvious in the Greek than in the Hebrew. As you know, in the Hebrew Bible, you have different terms to call God, you know. And one of them is the Tetragrammaton. And early in Jewish tradition, they stopped pronouncing the Tetragrammaton, because it's sacred, and you know, you shouldn't, you know, use the word, you know, in vain. So let's not use it at all, so that we don't risk making any mistake. So okay, but then if I read the Bible, what do I say then? And then of course different options came, and one of the options was to use Adonai, my Lord, or the Lord, you know, okay, O Lord, you know. Right, okay. This tradition existed before Jesus. We have evidence in the Dead Sea Scrolls that already 100 years before Jesus, there was already this tradition that when you have the Tetragrammaton, you don't pronounce it, but you say Adonai. And then later on, they said Hashem or Shema in Aramaic, and you know, another traditions. But now the Greek translations, they say, okay, what do we do now? I say, okay, we'll translate Lord in Greek, which is Kyrios in Greek. Okay, but what do you do when the Hebrew text has Adonai in full letters? And then in both cases, both words are pronounced the same way. I can show you an example in Hebrew. I think you know more about I guess most of you know Hebrew and not many of you know Greek. So I'll just give you a quick example in the Hebrew to show you how it can become difficult. I have to zoom in here. Right. So this is a manuscript of Isaiah. And here the scribe writes, so you have the lines, 1 line, 2 lines, 3 lines. And he writes the tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And then he says, oh no, it's not the tetragrammaton, it's supposed to be Adonai. Aleph, Dalet, you can read, see that, Vav, Nun, Yod, Adonai. So he corrects it, because the two words, he pronounces them the same way. So if you recite, let's say, imagine you know by heart the text.
Where
and you recite,
in Isaiah is this?
It's in chapter 3. Mm-hmm. And then 2 lines later, the opposite happens. He writes his text. And he writes Adonai in full letters. They said, oh no, it's not Adonai in full letters. It's the tetragrammaton. But because both are written the same way, if he knows by heart, or if someone is dictating the text to him, and he copies because someone... And if they say Adonai in both cases, which Adonai are written? Like the full letters or the tetragrammaton. So the same thing happened then in Greek. You have Greek manuscripts where both words are written kurios, kurios, kurios. And so the term Lord... Kyrios in Greek becomes both like the Lord, Lord, and also the tetragrammaton. And then you end up with texts in the New Testament, like in Jude, the book of Jude, which is an epistle which was written in Greek. And they discuss about, and they use the term Lord, our Lord, Kyrios, and they use the term Kyrios for Jesus, right? So Kyrios, the Lord, is Jesus. He is the Lord. Now, the term Adon can be used for many people. Even now, people say Adoni, you know, they want to be Mr. You know, so the word Adon itself is okay. You can use the term Lord for, you know, people that you want to give honor. But then he goes on to talk about the Lord who saved the people out of Egypt. And he talks about the tetragrammaton, the Lord. Now we're talking about God. In one sentence, you say the Lord Jesus, and then the Lord rescued the people in Egypt. But all right, which Lord are you referring to? Is it, are you talking about the tetragrammaton, the Lord like Moses, or are you talking about Jesus? Because the term Kyrios was used both for Jesus as Lord and for the tetragrammaton, then people at some point confused the two, and it also helped in a way. In the discussions, you know, I told you that the disciples of Jesus is the Messiah, okay. He comes from God, okay. But is he God himself? Is he divine? Is he just a human being, like a prophet, even the greatest prophet of all, if you want, or is he God himself? And there have been discussions and disagreements, and even the disciples of Jesus, they split. And so you talk about the Ebionite, for instance, very quickly, the generations that followed after Jesus in the first and second centuries, they were fighting in the third century, and it went on, you know, people fighting about, you know, is Jesus God or not? But this discussion and between the people, and especially those who said that Jesus is God, they said, look at verses like that, you know, Jesus is the Lord, and then the Lord saved the people from Egypt, so that's Jesus. And he's the one and the same with the tetragrammaton. So this is also another, I didn't want to go into that, but you raised the issue and it's fascinating. Yeah, I know, I'm sure we could spend days and days, but But you see, this is important for us, whether we are Jews believing in Jesus, Jews not believing in Jesus, Christians not Jews believing in Jesus, whatever. All of us who are interested in these matters, we need to pay more attention to the Greek, to see how the use of the Greek language influenced the development of the Jesus movement in the first centuries. And that's my conclusion.
Yeah. That's very good.
Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for all you have given us today. It has been very fascinating. Yeah. And I know you need to run after.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Because you have something else, but we want to leave you with some time. do you have it?
No, I don't have it. I told you about this book.
Yeah, yeah, so this is research about the Jewish beliefs in Jesus and how the way
very nice
split and everything, the first to the 5th century.
Wow, yeah, yeah, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for being here. And maybe we'll see each other again. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So was it 12th November you're not here?
No, I'll be the 12th of November I'm not here. The 13th I'm here. Somehow I need to fly on the 13th and I might stay for a few days. Yeah.
Accordance.
Accordance Bible software.
Accordance,
not concordance, accordance, A C C or, and so you, it's like of a digital library, and you can buy whatever book you want and versions you want, and it's very good. It's expensive, but it's the best.
Yeah.
For research, you know, you can have the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can have the Targums. Yeah, I have many things. Yeah, even have pictures of the manuscripts. I have all of the Targumim. I can do research. I have,
it's,
you know,
right there.
You can have Hebrew inscriptions from the Kingdom of Israel and Judah, you know, from the First Temple period, you know, and research, like, is this word somewhere, and they tell you, yeah, you have this word. And so it's the best.
And then the question, how do we know that Paul and his disciples translated Hebrew verses in the New Testament from that Christian and Jewish Greek, or it was changed theology?
Aha. Well, so, yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes we don't know. Sometimes we know because, well, we can see that the text perfectly matches like the Greek translation that we have. And this Greek translation we know is before Christian era, so before Jesus. So we know that they're not making up something like something new. They're just quoting one of the versions of the Bible within Judaism at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a few cases where, you know, it doesn't match any of the known versions of the Bible. And that's when people said, oh, Paul is doing a tricky thing here. He's twisting the text to fit his own theology. That's what people used to say, because they couldn't think of another explanation. But now we have evidence that at the time of Paul, there were even more versions, Greek versions of the Bible, and that he might have simply been quoting.
Used it.
I was able to...
Well, the version that we have Paul today, was that the original, or could it be the church fathers already? What we have...
Ah, so the manuscripts that we have, of course, we like, for instance, we don't have the actual letters that Paul wrote, for instance. Of course, this is gone. But we have manuscripts, fragmentary manuscripts, that are 100 years or 200 years later, and then... From the 4th century onwards, I showed you on the screen the Codex Vaticanus, so we have complete Greek Bibles. And then, of course, we can compare. And that's a whole thing in itself, what we call textual criticism. That is, you put side by side all of the Greek manuscripts. There are 5,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. So you put them and you compare if there are differences, and you try to figure out, if there are differences, which one would have been the earliest or the original version. Sometimes we can come at a pretty good conclusion. Sometimes we just don't know.
So yeah. We need to guess
or we need to wait for new discoveries. I'm always saying, you know, I don't. I prefer to say I don't know, and I hope that, you know, 10 years, 20 years from now, we have new discoveries that shed light, rather than coming up with theories that, you know.
You kept on saying the prominence of Greek. So, but now, amongst the scholars, right, sometimes Jesus is quoting Hebrew, but certainly the Tanoim, the Pharisees at the time, it seems the Mishnah was recorded in Hebrew. So it seems to be more the common people, maybe Aramaic and Hebrew, but still the leaders and the, you know, the rabbis, they still seem to stay with the Hebrew before and after Jesus.
So, yeah, Hebrew as a spoken language is attested in Judea. So we know, like, even Bar Kokhba, he writes letters, and the language evolves. So it's a living language, right? Some people at some point in the history of scholarship said, you know, Hebrew was a dead language, and that's not true. Nobody spoke Hebrew, that's not true. We have evidence now that people continue to speak Hebrew, but mainly in Judea and around. Like, you know, just here, not in Galilee. It was those people spoke only Aramaic. But even those who spoke Hebrew as a living language used Aramaic more, because even here in Judea, in daily life,
Most of the inscriptions we have are in Aramaic, though. But of course, people knew Hebrew, and it's obviously the case for the scholars, would say the scribes, the rabbis, those people. Of course, they knew Hebrew perfectly well, and they were able to compose new books in Hebrew. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have a number of them that are compositions in excellent Hebrew, and they know Hebrew very well. And of course, we have the Mishnah. We have evidence that the language has evolved a little bit. The syntax is different, so you have an evolution. But still, you have people who are perfectly able to have compositions in Hebrew, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. I'm sorry I have to go because I need to pick up a car, and the rental car closes at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so they told me if I'm not there at 2 p.m., I don't get the car. Because we are going to visit the Dead Sea. I'm bringing people to visit Qumran and the Dead Sea, so we need to rent a car. So they're waiting for me. So I was very happy to be here with you this morning, and I hope to see you again soon. You don't hesitate to contact me. There's my website, or you have my email. You can have my contact information, and we can meet again, of course.
And I told them we've got a lot of recording on YouTube.
Oh yeah, but it's in French though.
My
classes, yes, of course. Some of my classes in at the University of Strasbourg are on YouTube, but it's in French, obviously. So.
Okay, without text.
But anyway, I was really, really, it was a pleasure. So
yeah.
God bless you all.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And I think most of you already know that we are soon coming to the time when we will have this discovering Jesus.